to say that this is Granger Westberg, and I'm talking today on June 29th, is it? On both good grief and bad grief. And I'll try to move a little faster today. Generally, we try to take about an hour and a quarter to an hour and a half for every presentation. And this one, I'm going to try to do in much less time, obviously, and see where we can get to in 30 minutes so that I can get your reflections on this and deal with it where you are and the kinds of questions you have. I'd like to start with the idea that there are different sizes and shapes of grief. And that the first type that I'd like to talk about has to do with small griefs or little griefs, like little bit sick. But I'd like to put them on this line. I hope to draw a straight line, but I couldn't. That is supposed to be a straight line. And just to say, if that represents growth toward maturity, then none of us would say that growth toward maturity is a straight line going up. That it's a very rugged line. And so we'll just say that that's where we'd like to go, and we're heading in that direction, but it goes slowly. So the average person goes along on a kind of a straight line much of life, and you can just speak of that as a plateau. And we are on plateaus of a considerable part of our lives. Then some small thing happens which throws us into a dip. So the second stage is the dip. You can think of that as related to small things that happen, like, let's say you're taking a course at the nearby college just to keep yourself up to date, or you have to do it for your accreditation and your work, and you're signing up for an evening course that meets on Tuesdays and Thursday nights, and you hear the prof say the first night that he has a reading list of three books he wants you to read, and he wants you to get at this right away because he's going to have a quiz in a short time, and he wants to know where you are. And if you don't pass that quiz, you're out of the course. But you happen to have started the course at a time when you're terribly busy with many other things. And so you've been just going to class, and you're going to get to those books. But on the third week, Tuesday night, he says, Thursday night we'll have a quiz over the three books that I said I was going to give you a quiz over. You haven't cracked a book yet. You then have been on this plateau, and you now go into this dip, you see. And there you are in the dip. Once you hit the dip, you have three choices. Choice number one is to decide you're going to drop out of that course because you just can't do it, and you shouldn't have started that course at that time because you knew you had other things to do, but you thought you could squeak by. Your second choice, then, is not to drop out of the course, but to try to squeak by and to say, well, I think I could bluff my way. I'll just, do the best I can and see if I can get by. And sometimes that's what we choose to do. Your third choice is to say that you're going to do something about it, but you're going to really give your whole self to this thing. This is Tuesday night, and you've got all day Wednesday and all day Thursday to get ready for this. So you decide that you're going to take the third choice, which is the thrust. And so you thrust upward by you push everything else aside for those 2 days, and all you do is just barrel on these books. And by George, you thrust upward, and you are able to pass that quiz and stay in the course. The dip in that case, you accept it not as something negative, but as a challenge. other days we've been together, we've been talking about the causes of illness. And we said that among the names that can be given are loss, grief, stress, life changes, and basically the most important one was outlook on life. If you look at this dip from a negative standpoint and say, oh no, there I go again, I can't make it, I know I can't, it isn't going to work, and you do not see it as challenge, then you're going to spend a lot of your life dropping out of things, and perhaps you did that already with another course that you took and just dropped out because you couldn't make it. I did this recently. I took a course over at the junior college on voice training because I felt I needed some singing training. I haven't been singing for a long time. And I got to class and there were about six or eight young people there and I was the only old man. But then about 10 more came in, and then we had to stand up and sing in front of everybody individually, and I was so embarrassed. I went back two times, three times, four times. By the fourth time, I wasn't improving at all, and I dropped out of the course, so I chose number one. And then about 6 weeks later, at the end of the course, through the computer, I received a letter saying I had failed the course, and I got an F. So there I am, and I know what I'm talking about. This is a little grief for me. How long does one stew about such griefs? Well, let's say that you all have little griefs going on. Perhaps in a typical day you'll have two or three little griefs. Maybe you won't have more than one a day, maybe only one a week. But how you handle little griefs affects how you're going to handle the larger griefs. And I think we ought to be very much aware that griefs are around us constantly. So just to put a number on it, and don't hold me to the numbers, let's say that little griefs take anywhere from, say, three days to 3 weeks. And that we handle these griefs pretty much by ourselves, and many times other people don't even know we're going through them. Then we go along, but in a sense, if we respond to the dip as a challenge, we now have moved up and we now level off here.
But,
yes?
The implication that dropping out of a course or not doing something puts you down and away from the growth to maturity, I think I don't agree with that. I think that sometimes dropping out and accepting the fact that you can't do that particular thing is more a positive step towards maturity than trying to beat yourself into the ground trying to meet that particular challenge. You know, and so both of them can be growth towards maturity.
All right.
By just accepting learning to accept what you are, and actually that's probably more helpful in many instances because it does relieve stress to finally accept what you are and not trying to do something that's unrealistic.
All right. Would you then, in trying to diagram it, because whenever you try to diagram anything, it's real hard to do, would you say that here you are down here, and you now wrestle with this whole thing and see that that was probably a good decision and maybe move up from here someplace? I'm not sure, and I won't try to work on that right now because I don't have enough time. But that's an interesting question to raise. So you, let's say you thrust upward then, and then what do you do after that course, let's say, that you decided to work hard on and you did? You've been resting. You rested for the first 3 weeks, you see, on a plateau. But you can't keep going on the thrust forever, so you're going to rest again for the next weekend, but we're going to suggest that you not rest in that course for 3 weeks. And then you have other dip thrusts, opportunities, and thrust and more plateaus, and dip thrust plateaus. What I'm trying to show is that this is what life is like. And when you hit the bottom here, these are the moments of growth or moments of decision, as Billy Graham might say. And It's these decisive points that I think are essential to understanding how to deal with losses and griefs. Now, suppose you're going along and things are going fairly well, but then out of the blue, something happens, let's say in a relationship with some person who is very important to you. You've been going along without much happening, and then this thing happens in a, whatever the upset was, and you go into a deeper dip. Now, you have the same moment of decision here, of either to run away from this person or whatever the problem was, and to try to just put it out of your mind entirely, or to just muddle through and not work at it very hard, which is your second chance, or to respond to it with as a challenge and a thrust. But notice now the difference. You're not able, because this is a middle size, let's call this a middle size grief. You're not able to come clear back all of a sudden, but you respond to it with a challenge concept and you thrust upward a certain distance, but don't expect to go much higher at first, because you're going to have to level off again to kind of pull your forces together, and then you're going to have to be stimulated again in some kind of dip thrust. To me, the dip is should not be thought of as only a negative thing. For instance, if I'm going to jump from this position, I can't, because I'm already at the position that I don't have the springiness. I've got to get down. And so the dip to me is kind of like where you put all your effort together with your muscles, and now you are able to jump. And I see the dip as saying, boy, I've got to deal with this issue. I've got to deal with it. And even your muscles work together for dealing with it. And then you force yourself up. So it's dip, challenge, thrust. Dip, challenge, thrust. Dip, challenge, thrust. And you see what we're trying to show here is that if you deal with the issues of life in this fashion, there is some growth taking place as a result of handling it in a constructive fashion. So here we're on the way toward maturing. You can also think of this as kind of like with railroad tracks. We have many tracks that you and I are on each day. I have a track with myself and my wife, with myself and any of my four children. I have a track with people that I'm working with in my work. So you've got maybe, what, 20, 30 tracks going all the time. With one person, I may be with my wife down in a small dip. With a son, I may be in a deeper dip. With a daughter, I may be on an upsurge, and so on. So I've got, if I have too many dips, then I'm being pushed into the middle-sized grief. But if I have lots of thrusts, I may be better able to handle life generally. Nobody has just one track at any given time. We're all on many tracks. And I, when I'm listening to somebody who's telling me of some great thing going on in their life, I want to know, tell me what's going on other tracks as well. How are you handling this relationship? How are you handling that? If all the relationships are bad, this person is really in trouble. How long does it take to handle middle-sized griefs? Well, I don't really know, but let's just say generally from anywhere from 3 weeks to 3 months to work out some of those. Then I'm going along and hoping that things are going to be okay, and plateaus do occur in our lives, and we are certainly grateful for them, but we're not growing much as a result of them. We seem to have to be under some kind of stress, some kind of challenge, in order to grow. Now, there are times when I wish I had a better way of diagramming this, because when I said here that you do have, after you've read those books and so forth, what's going to motivate you to continue to grow? Well, I would guess that the professor himself or herself is going to be the motivator to some extent, and it wouldn't be probably too accurate to put it in this fashion. So maybe it has to be kind of a curly tail here that says, this person inspires me and moves me up, and I have that kind of motion. But I can't illustrate things the way I'd like, so we just have to be satisfied. Now you're going along and handling life pretty well, and then either one catastrophic thing happens in your life, or one darn thing after another happens, and the things seem to come in bunches, and you are pushed down, 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 down. And now you have what we call an overwhelming grief. This is what doctors and nurses and pastors and perhaps lawyers and some others spend most of their professional lives dealing with. People who are going through overwhelming griefs of one kind or another. But I think they look just like these, except they're bigger. And if we understand what's going on in the little griefs and the middle-sized griefs, we may not be quite as overwhelmed by the major griefs. Now I'd like to take this large grief and talk about it, but I'm at the same time talking about the other size griefs also, but just in larger focus. So we'll put it over, we'll move this one from here over to here. We're going along like this, and then we bump into, we have either a series of awful things happening to us, or one catastrophic grief of the loss of a spouse or whatever it may be, and we go down, down, down. Now, when we hit the bottom here, we have the same problem that we have there. We have moments of decision. How am I going to handle this? Choice number one is to drop out of the whole thing entirely. In this case, that means suicide. And that is what we see from time to time. So that suicide is the one way out, and the obviously the worst way out. The second way out is to deal with this at a low level, but not really to deal with it, just to kind of clam up and be in our own world and be unwilling to relate to anything else around us. And this moves into depression. Most depressions that I see are related to actual things that are going on in a person's life. And I'm bothered, and I was bothered 20 years ago when I was first, 40 years ago when I was first introduced to depression and psychoses, so-called, or neuroses, as if it were, as they called it, endogenous, which means it comes from within and it's just it's a physical thing entirely. Most depressions I see are exogenous. They come from the result of one's relationships to one's fellows. And that most depressions can be handled by that form of relating anew to the world around one. The third alternative is the one, of course, we're hoping we can develop and deal with, is the thrust challenge, or the dip challenge. Now, let's just say that we're dealing with the problem of alcoholism. This is what we see in alcoholism a great deal, is the person going into a very deep dip, and ending up in the gutter or wherever he does, and being brought back to life by helpful friends, and then hoping that we can get this man or woman to want to really make a change in his way of dealing with life and not deal with it through alcohol. And he says, I can handle this myself. And we say, no, we think you ought to join Alcoholics Anonymous and you ought to really get involved with this. No, 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 I can handle it myself. And I'll bet you I can do it. And the man is so motivated that we can't do anything about it anyway, because he's going to do what he wants to do. And by George, he thrusts upward beautifully, about that high, and is doing well for 6-8 weeks or whatever, maybe months, and then he levels off and things are going pretty well, and then some external thing happens in his life, where he's faced with something at the job that's more than he can handle or whatever, and he goes into a dip again. But the interesting thing about this kind of dip from the Alcoholics Anonymous standpoint is that if this dip is deeper than that one, they will speak of this as a false bottom, and this as the true bottom. When a person hits the true bottom and comes up gasping and saying, I'll do anything because I know I can't handle it, then it seems that the AA movement, which is based, as you all know, on the way of Christian salvation and was started really by these two men plus an Episcopal minister, Shoemaker, in Pittsburgh, I think he was then, or Philadelphia, who really took the Christian way, ordo salutis, or the way of salvation, and showed them that step number one in the 12 steps has to be, I admit that I am powerless over alcohol. And step number two or three, whichever, I turn myself over, that isn't quite right, I give myself to a higher power, to God. I turn myself over to God. I get out of the driver's seat, I guess that's it. I get out of the driver's seat and turn myself over to God. I think this has been one of the most helpful psychological as well as deeply religious understandings that we have come across in the last half century. That it is only when we are willing to admit that we do not run our lives by ourselves, that there is a power greater than oneself, whom we call God, who, if we put ourselves completely in his hands, something entirely new happens. Now, don't get the impression that the thrust zooms right back up there to where we would like it to be, because it doesn't. It's a slow, slow process. But the difference between this one, the false bottom, and the true bottom is that here man is going to do it by himself. Here man says, I cannot do it by myself. It is only with the help of God. And I think this is most helpful to us as Christians, to know that that is a major part of our faith, that only as we can turn ourselves over completely in total surrender does anything truly great and long-standing take place. But the person still has to go through this awful experience of thrusting and plateauing and then facing difficulties again that throw him back into a dip, and he has to go through this same old thing again, and back up he goes and plateaus and dips and thrusts and plateaus, and we think everything is fine. All of a sudden, wham, goes way down again. It has to work at it. Now, I'm talking not only about alcoholics, though that is the most vivid illustration I can think of, but I'm really talking about all of us with all our relationships that bring about grief, particularly the loss of loved ones. And then we move upward, and then plateau, dip, thrust, plateau, dip, thrust. And finally, we come to what we would say is a relating to life in ways that are meaningful again. How long does this take? Again, please don't hold me to these numbers. To just keep with the threes again, let's say 3 months to 3 years. And as I put months there, I'm hesitant to say that because I think it isn't 3 months. I almost never see anybody handle it in 3 months. 3 years? Many people can handle it in 3 years, but a lot of people can't handle it in 3 years, and they need more than that. So just know that. Now, as I've been watching these people through the years, as they've been coming into the hospital, and as some of you have heard me say several times this week, about a third of all the patients I see in hospitals are there in close relationship to some grief which they are going through, some loss which they've experienced, which has made them sick, because the grief syndrome always includes physical symptoms. So let's look at the grief syndrome quickly now. You can all read this later in the little book, Good Grief, someday, so that you get it, but I'd just like a chance to put it down rather quickly and then let you come at me with questions. The first thing that I would say shows up is shock. The person is really thrown into shock. I can't believe that this has happened. I just can't believe it. The other word for it, or the psychological word, is denial. And we speak of it as the denial mechanism. It hasn't happened. I don't believe it. I know that he died or she died, but I just walk around like I'm I'm in a daze. I can't believe it. Now that's not all bad. If the awfulness of this separation were to hit us completely at one time, we would just be thrown flat on our faces and we'd be able to do nothing. So be grateful for the denial mechanism that says, I can't believe it's happened, because that's okay. But we mustn't let that happen too long. And we've seen this happen in many different ways. I think I've said this in the little booklet. This happened to be a chapter in one of my books one time, and that's why it's now in a small paperback that's so small it keeps getting lost, and booksellers say, we can't find it, it falls between the cracks. And it does. But one of the things that I was thinking of is here's a man who just died of a heart attack yesterday, and now the friends are gathered at the funeral parlor, and this happened to me once, something like this. I walked in, there was a large crowd there gathered around the casket and talking to the wife, who was very able to express her, well, she just looked great. She was just in wonderful, had wonderful ability to greet people and smile and so on. And somebody came up to me and said, gee, Pastor, you can sure tell she's a good Christian, can't you? And you know what I felt like saying. I didn't quite. Then I said something like this. In the course of several minutes, we got a few things said like, kind of curious to know why you'd say she's a good Christian. Well, because look how she's handling grief. In other words, if you're a good Christian, you really handle grief. Oh, yeah, yeah. Christians, you mean Christians then don't cry? Well, you know, the Bible says, grieve not. Well, but that's only part of the verse. What's the rest of the verse? Oh, is there more? Grieve not as those who have no hope. Oh. So what we have tended to do in the Christian faith is to stress the fact that if you're really a good Christian, you do not grieve. Grieve not. So I'm hoping that you will all put a big comma here, which I admit isn't there. Grieve not. Oh no, just the opposite. We don't want a comma there. That's what everybody does. Grieve not. There's no comma there. Grieve not as those, and so on, who have no hope. But for goodness sake, if you have something to grieve about, please, please grieve. Otherwise, you stay in shock and you live a life that's separate from the world, and you will never relate to the world again. And a lot of people in mental hospitals went there, in the old days at least, because they went into their own cocoon and wanted to stay there where it was safe. So we must move to the second stage, which is emotional release. And here we have all kinds of problems for men in particular, because as men and as little boys, we were taught we were never supposed to cry. And little boy falls and he starts to cry and somebody says, oh, little boys don't cry, little boys don't cry. You're not doing that anymore, and I'm glad you're not. And one of the things that thrills me on this campus is to see the nurturing, motherly spirit of these young fathers taking care of children. I can't, you know, I didn't see that for up until recently, that fathers felt it was okay to not just wrestle with their children, but to be loving and quiet and sweet and endearing and, you know, all the best words you can think of. So maybe this is not going to be a problem for our children, but for us as men, this has been a problem. Men don't cry. and they've got to find other ways to release their tension. The third thing I put here is the word depression. And I put this in purposely, knowing that the whole experience that we're describing here is a depression. But I just wanted it there to know that everybody going through this kind of loss, or any kind of loss, has moments of, or long periods of depression. The fourth thing that I sensed was, and this is where I came into the act, was being a hospital chaplain for 8 years, I saw all these people who were having physical symptoms. And now we're aware that everybody who grieves has physical symptoms. Not all of them look alike, and some are very obvious and some are not very obvious at all. But you know what happens if you're very hungry and you sit down to a meal and you're just starting to eat and all of a sudden the phone rings and you get very bad news about a friend of yours. You don't care to eat again. You don't care to go back to the table. Your body says, I've got other things to take care of. Don't put any food in me now. I'm not ready for it. The body is so terribly sensitive that you know that the minute you are frightened by something, that your whole body responds. It's so quick that I am always amazed that the body can send those signals to every part of the body so that your whole body responds. But you, in the holistic concept, are everything that is included in your body, and you can't get away from it. So I'm constantly saying to ministers, as I work with ministers, whenever you're dealing with physical symptoms, just kind of try to find out, could this be a symptom because of some loss or grief or stress that they're going through? And the symptoms are just that, just symptoms. Number five, I put way down here, and I've been trying to decide which words to use, so I use both of them. The first word I use is panic. I better get on my knees. Panic is what I see very often, but the other word that I think has to be used here is anxiety. Because I think the word anxiety is a bigger word, and almost everybody who's ever amounted to anything in this world, if you read their biography, you will find that they went through periods of anxiety, which is this bottom point here, where they had the choices of 1, 2, or 3. And if they amounted to something, and if they came out of it, they normally chose 3. Not always, but 3 seems to be the one that helps them to grow. But anybody who's ever amounted to anything has a life that looks like that. It's just filled with all kinds of dips and plateaus and thrusts and all of these things. And we hate it. We wish that our lives would look like this. And I think we'd all agree, if only our lives would be on a plateau where things would be dependable, we can live a quiet, easy life. This is a description of a cow. And you just have to know that, that's all. This is the description of a human being. And strangely enough, the bigger the human being, the greater the man or woman through the centuries that we've been studying, the greater the depths, the greater the dips and thrusts and plateaus are. So this is what we look like, and this is what we've got, and I don't really think in the long run we would care to look like that. So this is where the way we grow toward maturity, and that's why I keep thinking that grief can be good. A constructive approach to the problem of loss. So we begin coming up out of all of this in 5. The panic comes forth in, I should tell you too, that I get more letters on that one than any other, because what I've said with that one is that the person says, I am losing what? My mind. This is what people are convinced that they're losing. And I've gone through something like this because I once took a job that I wasn't qualified to handle. And I went into a dip such as I couldn't believe that I was ever capable of going into. And there were moments when I really thought, you know, something's going wrong here. I think I'm losing my mind. And then, now this sounds crazy, but I went and got my little book and opened it up and I said, you know that this is true, that people are not losing their minds. They're going through a period of anxiety and you are not losing your mind. I just had to keep the book open on my desk and refer to it from time to time. I really, you know, I really believe in this book. I think it's true. So I didn't lose my mind, I think. I'm still around. Number six is anger. Now, you might argue with me and say, well, anger is over here too. Sure, it's over here. But, and I used to call it hostility, and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross said, Granger, just call it anger, because that's what you mean. See, she has only 5 steps, and I've got 10. But I wrote my book 15 years before she wrote hers. And by the way, she followed me by only 2 weeks at the University of Chicago. And if you read her book on death and dying, you'll find that she is quoting the chaplain there, a nice longer, who had medical students and theological students that I had been working with him. And they were trying to find a doctor who would be willing to work with them in the wards of the Goldblatt Cancer Research Center, and no doctor wanted to work with us. And then she came, and somebody happened to meet her, and she said she was new there, new psychiatrist, and she joined us, and from then on, this whole thing has changed, joined them, I wasn't there. And what a difference this little woman has made. After 3 years, when in university you have to be checked in whether you will continue on tenure, she did not get tenure because she was upsetting what was going on in that school. Even the University of Chicago did not see greatness there. And I can't believe that they would do that. But she was let out. Anger is there. Now, depression over here, the word for depression, the little word is sad. The little word for anger is mad. This is what is present in all grief situations. Sadness is there. I even see it in little old ladies and men in retirement homes, some that are just so sad. And one that I remember working with over a period of months, how I could never get her to loosen up. And finally, as I would try to say to her, I'm sure there are times when you are angry with God for the way things have turned out in your life. Oh, no, no. Oh, you're never supposed to be angry with God. But maybe 6 months later it was that one day she said, you know, I shouldn't say this, but there are times when I want to shake my fist at God, which is what sadness is. A sad person is always angry. It's there. But it must be dealt with and not held back. Number seven is guilt. Oh my, I found guilt and still find guilt all over the place. And this is where I really took exception to psychiatry, because I felt that psychiatry was not dealing with guilt in its true sense, because it just didn't seem to have a theory for guilt. And I feel that the Christian faith really deals with true guilt or false guilt, and has the only answer to guilt, which is forgiveness. And forgiveness was not generally in the picture. So guilt is there. And we must be helpful to people to deal with it, because a person has these awful feelings. I think of a lady who was about 60, and every day she was in the hospital sitting all day and all night with her mother, who was, say, 80, 85, who was dying and was in a coma. And this went on for days and days, and finally the doctor said, you just have to go home and get some rest. No, no, I want to be here. I want to be here in case mother wakes up. And, well, he finally got her to go home, gave her something to sleep with. And, of course, that was the night her mother died. And then some kind friend told her that her mother had wakened just before death. She went into a tizzy like I haven't seen in a long time. And she was unconsolable. All she kept saying to all her friends was, I was a terrible daughter. I was a terrible daughter. I wasn't there when Mother awakened. I've always been a terrible daughter. And they would all say, Martha, you haven't been a terrible daughter. You are a wonderful daughter. And all the good things, and it just made her feel worse. And then one day she was alone with one of her friends who knew something about counseling, apparently, and who said, after she had made this statement, I'm such a terrible daughter, you really feel then that you were a terrible daughter? And she jumped to think that anybody would pick her up on it. Tell me about it. Tell me about it. And then the story came out that she and her mother had not spoken a civil word in the past 5 years, and that that's what she wanted to say finally to her mother. That was true guilt, and true guilt needed to be dealt with. And then this Christian person was able to help her with, though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be white as snow, and her own acceptance of her. And from then on, she had a different way of dealing with her guilt. Number eight is, if I can get this to come out, resistance to change. Nobody, for some reason, wants, we talk about variety is the spice of life, but oh, how we hate change that's just a little more than we had asked for. And we hold on to it for all we're worth. I've been meeting lately with groups called Compassionate Friends, who are parents of children who have died. This is what I hear almost every meeting. Somebody tells how they have kept the room for their 8-year-old daughter who was killed in an auto accident or whatever, just as it was when she died. And now it's 6 months, and they haven't let anybody else from that family go into that room. They haven't touched it. And for me to say anything wouldn't carry much weight. But they get off in a small group of maybe 6 or 8 parents with her and with her husband. And little by little, they are able to convince her that this is not the way to handle it. That she is rubbing up against a wall, and she's trying to live on this side of the wall, and somehow she's going to have to realize that she's going to have to turn to the left or the right and start a new way of living. And I just think these new support groups, particularly the Compassionate Friends, which has grown in 5 years beyond anything. I think they have 275 chapters all over America. And one of the founders was the Missouri Synod pastor, two blocks from the church where I have my office in Hinsdale, Don Bolster. And that's how important that support group is for parents who have lost children, as Don and his wife lost their son. 12-year-old boy just riding his bicycle hit a bump, threw him off over, hit a curbstone, and died. And they have been helpful to literally thousands of people as a result of it, as Christian friends. Number nine is that gradually, and I mean gradually, gradually hope comes through. If we didn't have the word hope in our Christian vocabulary, we would be in terrible shape. But it is a wonderful thing to know that God has always has planted that so that hope springs eternal in the human breast. I think of this in relation to a day that I was taking a plane out of Midway Airport a number of years ago. It was a terrible day, dark, drizzly day. It was so dark that we all had to drive with our headlights on. And I got into the plane and my seatmate said, looks like midnight out there. And it surely did, just as dark as it could be. And then the plane took off and we very quickly went through these layers of clouds and all of a sudden the sun came bursting through the window. And he said, huh, look at that sun. The people downstairs are saying the sun isn't shining today. Look at it. And that's what the people downstairs are saying frequently about whatever's going on in their lives of grief. There is no God. The sun isn't shining today. We know the sun is shining. We know that technically with our minds. But we say the sun isn't shining. We should say something is keeping the sun from me at the present time. But the sun is still there. God is still there. Something is keeping his presence from being meaningful to me at this moment. But it's there. And finally, number 10 is that we can reaffirm reality. I used to say we, trying to think what words I used, we adjust to reality. And somebody said, adjust sounds pretty mechanical. Seems to me you're talking about a spiritual component here as well. And of course I was. And they said, you know, what about the word to affirm something? And this way you are reaffirming something terribly important in your life. And I have felt good about that. If you have an early copy of my book from some years ago, it said adjust. And now it says reaffirm. Because you did believe in life once, you lost your belief in the meaning of life for a time, and now you are reaffirming your idea of life. Now that doesn't mean that you are the same person, the same old person you were before. Because I believe that as a result of this awful experience, you are now at a slightly higher level, or maybe even quite a higher level of maturity than you were before. You are a deeper person than you were before because you've been down in the depths and you know what it's like to be down there. You are a stronger person than you were before because you've had to use your spiritual muscles to climb this very steep grade. You are a person better able to help other people because you have been there. And you don't stand up above the canyon with a person down in the depths and say, come on up here and I'll talk to you. You go down there and you know how to walk alongside people and to help them through the rugged path that brings them out of the valley. Now, that's to me good grief. Bad grief is related to several of these points, and I'm just going to mention them briefly. I see most bad grief, a lot of bad grief, not most, a lot of bad grief related to number one. I see bad grief related to number four, physical symptoms. I see it related to anger. I see it related to grief, to guilt. The one story that I remember particularly about, and I see I'm going over time, I just can't put it in that short time, but I'll finish quickly. Because I want time for your responses. I think of the story in a psychiatric journal of a woman who was, let's say, 23 years old and was married, was married at a church or whatever, a big wedding. They went off on their honeymoon, and during the honeymoon, he was killed and died. And she went into shock, and they could never get her out of the shock. She just was absolutely unable to communicate with anybody, and they tried everything, but this was in the 1920s, as I recall it. And so finally they had to put her in a mental hospital and force feed her, and she was put in the back wards and so on. Long about 1940s, 20 years later, that there was this revolution in mental health care, and instead of calling it an insane asylum, they now call it a mental health center or mental health hospital or whatever. And a new superintendent came into that home and went out to the churches and said, we could use some help as volunteers. Well, they had never had anything like that before. And so a group of ladies came in and were given kind of an introduction and then taken, for some reason, into the back wards. And they came into a ward, perhaps the size of this one, with people sitting around as they do. And the ladies were told they could sit with anybody they wanted. And so one of the ladies went and sat with this woman who had not, oh, I forgot to say, had not spoken in 20 years. And she sat with her and tried to engage her in conversation. And there was just no response, just completely out of touch with reality. But when she finished that day, spending some time with her, she was attracted to her and asked if the next time she came, she could go back and spend her full time with just that woman. And they said, sure. So she kept going back and eventually added a second day a week and perhaps maybe a third, but she began to feel that she was getting someplace, though nothing had happened yet in the way of speech. But some bodily movements had shown that the woman was at least listening. Then one day in the summer, in the spring, she took her out for a walk, and then they went to the commissary and got an ice cream cone. And as she handed the lady the ice cream cone, the lady said, thank you. Almost perhaps the first word she had spoken in 20 years. That was the beginning of a word here and there. Over a period of a year of this kind of caring, this woman began to come through it. She was able to move through the grief syndrome, which is now what this is often called, and to express her emotions for the first time, which she had not been able to express before. The depression was there, of course. Physical symptoms of all different types were there, but she had somebody to walk with her through this, and I think it was a year and a half later, she was released, perfectly healthy, perfectly normal. Now, was she insane during those 20 years? I don't think so. She was just in deep grief and was in shock, and nobody was there to help her to walk through it. She was scared to death to move from here. Here she was safe. She lived in her own little world. But somebody came along who could walk through the valley with her, and she made it through it and came out and was perfectly normal again. A lot of so-called insanity in the past has not been insanity of the brain, nothing wrong with the brain at all. It's just that they were unable to face reality until somebody or something happens in their lives that makes it possible. Physical symptoms, we see this all the time. I remember coming into a church where a lady was who, in the coffee hour afterwards, she came rushing up to me to tell me about her husband who had died and what a terrible thing this was, and she tears poured down. And finally I said, when did this happen? And she said, 25 years ago. And she had been in poor health. She was enjoying poor health for many years. And she just had one thing after another. And she was stuck here. And believe me, she was stuck. I think of a relative of mine who died recently at age 82 or something, whose daughter had leukemia and died at age 8, and who has been angry with God and man ever since, and has made an absolutely miserable adjustment to life ever since that happened. His wife, on the other hand, made her adjustment within about a 3-year period and has had a rich, full life. We decide, to some extent at least, we choose how we are going to respond to loss, grief, stress, life changes. And it's our way of looking at life, our Christian faith or our lack of faith, our sickness of outlook, our wellness of outlook that makes the difference. Two people can have exactly the same thing happen. Three people standing on a street corner talking to each other. All of a sudden there's an auto accident a few feet away. One of them runs screaming away. A second one becomes rigid, can't move, paralyzed by what has happened. A third one goes over and helps. If you get a history of these people, my guess is that tends to be a description of the way they handle life situations. Exactly the same situation happening to three different people, each one handles it in his or her own way. You and I have all kinds of power to choose how we shall respond to life. And if we can respond with the help of God, as the Alcoholic Anonymous would suggest, that you put yourself in the hands of God and let Him be in charge, then life becomes rich again. Well, we've got 5-6 minutes for comments. Yes?
I'm curious, Carol, about your feeling about chemical depression.
Chemical, you mean brought on by chemistry?
Yeah, well, you hear the talk about the things are going on in the brain, and I'm not talking about taking medication, that kind of chemical reaction, but they're talking about he's depressed and it's something that's caused by the brain itself.
Yeah, I think what you need to do is to read some of the things that Norman Cousins has to say about it. Norman Cousins is fully aware, as you know now, he's a faculty member at the University of California Medical School in L.A., And he's been very into chemistry and all the rest as he works with the physicians. And as you know, he's one of the brightest men that I've ever met or known about. He puts it simply that it looks as if the brain is a whole drugstore in itself, and that it has all the chemicals necessary to make for change, what good or bad, in the human being, and that certain emotions trigger the use of certain drugs, so that these drugs suddenly shoot out into various parts of our body and do the good for them or the bad for them, whatever it may be. And with these two people that I'm speaking of in their 80s, with the father, I would say that his anger emotion sent the wrong prescription out and made his whole life rigid and developed all kinds of arthritis and a number of things like that, whereas his wife, with her good thoughts, sent the right prescription to the body, and the body responded. So yes, I would say chemicals are involved, but don't feel that you can be intimidated by chemicals. For a long time, we thought that the autonomic nervous system operated entirely by itself and that we had no control over it. Now we know that by putting a thermometer on your finger, that you can raise your temperature by, 6 degrees, just by thinking about coolness or warmness. And the autonomic nervous system is seen as something that maybe we are in more control of than we thought. Yes?
Your model of little and medium griefs, and then the thought of we run on many tracks, I believe you said,
yes,
and with this person, that person, in my mind, I could see that three-dimensional then and see a number of those charts, one behind another.
That's right.
And get a little better picture of how many dips are.
That's a good way to put it. If we could put them behind each other in paper that can be seen through, and you'd see the dip here and the ups, and then you add up the amount of the dips and the amount of thrusts, and you could tell whether the person is doing pretty well or not. Yeah?
How would you know if you have worked through a grief constructively? Say you had a loss in the past.
How would you know if you had worked through your grief constructively if you had a loss in the past? Anybody want to reflect on that? Because I'm sure you've all had losses in the past. Yes?
I would say that when you can speak of it again without crying, that you come to that plateau again.
At least to some plateau. Mm-hmm. All right, that would be one way. Any other thoughts on that? When you're able to communicate, yes?
I had an experience with child guidance of she was about 4 years old, and, she was closer to five, but Amy had never said a word in her life, and she was coming into child guidance, and in our play therapy, she took a little piece of cloth and held it to her face, and she was cuddled in my lap, and just wept and wept, and then in talking to her mother later, she had been hospitalized at a very early age and separated from her mother, and the mother had left her handkerchief, and the little child had had it by her. And when she went through that grief again, she was in therapy for about a year, this was not like the first time, but when she went through it again, in a safe, loving situation with someone, she rewalked that valley even before she had words.
That's right.
Stranger?
Yes.
Upstairs here.
Yes.
A couple of comments. One on lust, on sexual reaction to death. It's very natural and yet has a tendency to scare friends off. And in sharing my experience with a number of people who have gone through recent losses, almost to a person, they have said, yes, there have been moments where almost the next person passing wherever they live on that street corner, they were willing to just jump into bed with. And the communication when that is put forward to at least the closest friend sometimes can be taken so negatively that there's a loss upon a loss, and that's what happened to me, that instead of the response, I cannot do that for you, but I will hold you as long as you want me to or as often, it wasn't even countered with that, it was a running away. And I guess what I'm saying here is don't be frightened off by that, that it's, that's the extreme. I think it's the body's attempt to deal with death with some sort of life type activity. And the other comment is on suicide and in defense of suicide, in that at least it is an ultimate reaction to everything you've listed there. And for me, it was a turning point. But I think I had to go through that even before I started coming back up again.
I think all of us have to hit bottom to make anything real come of this. And I hope you hit the true bottom and not just the false bottom. Thank you very much. I see our time is up.